I am constantly amazed at how the passenger roles of Titanic continue to reach out to me, grabbing me with their wispy, ghost-like 112-year-old hands. Just a few weeks ago, we had some of our new neighbors over for dinner, and once we started talking about Titanic, because if you have dinner with me, I guess sadly it's inevitable. Some people probably wish it wasn't. And my lovely neighbor, Lindsay, who, to be clear, doesn't mind talking about Titanic, breaks out the revelation, oh, my engagement ring was designed by someone on the ship. And I dropped my cracker in my hand, and I think some kind of gloopy dip fell off of it, because to be honest, I didn't even know what she was talking about, full disclosure. 25 years after I discovered a love of this ship, and 3 years after I began researching it so heavily that some weeks it's the equivalent of a full-time job, and I'd never heard of Engelhart Ostby. He was a Norwegian immigrant who built a ring empire in Providence, Rhode Island. Lucille Lady Duff Gordon was on board Titanic, of course, the reigning queen of romantic Edwardian gowns and luscious, scandalous new styles of lingerie for women who were carving out their modern identities. But also this, a man and his daughter who he trained in the business, not his sons, on board with a satchel full of gemstones he'd hunted in Europe. Edwardian jewelry is coveted to this day, and it's easy to see why. It was the foundation for the romantic, whimsical, ethereal style that seeps into designs of jewelry and clothing all the way to this very moment. If you are a woman similar to my age, you've probably shopped at, say, Anthropology. That aesthetic is completely from this period's foundations. Jewel tones, when we think of them, of deep jade greens and pinks that also evoke some purple feelings. The colors like that's from these rings and this jewelry. Ostby had diamonds in his satchel on Titanic. They were not in his pocket when his body was found by the Mackay Bennett in the days after the sinking. So in this case, the diamonds did actually go down with the ship. You know, I can't not get a 1997 movie reference in there if possible. I'm LA Beatles, and this is Unsinkable, the Titanic podcast. And a diamond is forever. This is the story of the Ostby family. As always, top priority, top of the show, I must thank my newest Patreon members. I want to extend a huge Unsinkable thank you to Renee Gestalt, to Emily Scola, to Jillian Beauchamp, and to Aaron McConnell. Thank you for taking the time, for investing in the podcast, for being a part of the community over on Patreon. I appreciate every single one of my Patreon members. Every single day, you literally fuel the pod. I say it every time because it's true every time. And there's quite a community growing there. Of course, there's two ways to do Patreon. You can just support silently and listen to the bonus episodes, which a lot of people do. That's what I do for some podcasts, so I appreciate that. And then also, I have some Patreon members that love messaging and chatting with other members on there. There's a great community. We've had some meetups. We are going to do a book club in February, and we're going to read Unraveling the Myth about Molly Brown in a Zoom meetup book club. So there are lots of options there. Of course, the main perk is the monthly bonus episode. Once in a while, there's two per month when I throw something fun on there. But thank you, Patreon members. And I will keep the rest of, as most podcasters say, housekeeping things until the end. So I will jump into the story of the Ostbys. And I want to say my voice is not at 100%. I was taken down, as I think everybody in the world was around Christmas, by a little bit of a cold and fully lost my voice a couple of days after Christmas. A couple of days I couldn't even speak. One of the reasons I'm a little behind on recording, but my voice is a little tiny bit raspy. So I'm going to just fancy myself Phoebe from Friends and think that it makes me sound unbelievably wise and sexy, I guess. I don't know that it does. I'm just going to assume it. So we're going to jump into this tale, but I do want to thank my friend and neighbor, Lindsay, for bringing this topic to my attention. I don't know if you'll ever stumble upon listening to this episode. That's the thing about being a podcaster. You know, a lot of people in my life that hear the Titanic day to day and talk about it with me in my real life, IRL, don't necessarily feel like they need to listen to my episodes. And that's also 100% fine. I get that. So thank you, Lindsay. Inglehart Cornelius Ausby. What a name. And if I mispronounce Ausby at any point in this episode, I apologize. It's a very hard name to say, I've discovered through the recording of this episode. He was christened actually with the last name Christensen, and his father later adopted the last name Ausby, the way that we see it written now, O-S-T-B-Y. Some sources also put an E on the end of it. But he was born near Oslo in Norway in December of 1847. He had four sisters and, from what I could tell, I think two brothers, though the sources are a little bit unclear. And to be perfectly clear, we don't have a ton of biographical information that is, what's the best way to put this? Really run through the screener of factual accuracy. So I pieced together what I could from the sources that are reliable. So Inglehart studied to be a jeweler at the Royal School of Art, and this is in Oslo as well. He spent 6 years as an apprentice, which is very common in the arts during this time and obviously still is. He became a successful jeweler there in Norway, but his parents and one brother had already moved to the United States in, as we know, very common and large wave of Europe to the United States immigration that was going on in the back half of the 19th century. So he comes to America in 1869 at the age of 22. 1869 in the United States, we are fresh off of the Civil War, and the American cultural identity is very much up for grabs, in contention. There's a lot of different ways one could put that. He worked for Hunt and Owen in Providence, Rhode Island, and a company called Arnold and Webster, and was a head of design and engraving for them for 9 years. What's interesting to me is apparently if you were a jewelry company at this time, your name had to just be two last names put together with an and or ampersand in the middle. But also that, and I didn't know this, I discover so many things about American history I never knew studying Titanic, that Providence, Rhode Island was a bit of a jewelry headquarters, a jewelry capital of the world at this time, and would remain so well into the 20th century. Never knew that. So in 1879, he forms a partnership with Nathan B. Barton to create Ausby and Barton, which is a company that even if you never knew anything about Titanic, but you are a jeweler or work in the jewelry business in any way, I believe that you know that company name. They created a headquarters at 25 Potter Street in Providence. They later moved to Garnet Street. I always like to mention those details in case you are someone who lives in the city I'm talking about. It's fun to map down on a city that you know. I know when I listen to history podcasts or I read and there's a section about places I've lived or somewhere I currently live, it's always so amazing to imagine the past translated onto, is that the right way to put it? almost like a, it's almost like a translation of a map, right? Like reimagining what a place looks like now, with the past laid over it or under it, so to speak. So they became the world's biggest producer of gold rings at this time, which again, not anything that I ever would have known. So they then move to a large factory building because they are producing so much product at this time. They eventually move into a building of the Ladd Watch Case Company that had already been outfitted as a large warehouse and I guess the right type of building for their jewelry making needs. And by the way, I apologize about any noise. It's very rainy here today. And so even though I'm in my office with, you know, a typical amount of soundproofing, there is a hard rain against the window and any cars that pass by are making a lot of noise because we are under a flash flood warning. So he also became the director of High Street Bank and the Industrial Trust Company. He was a trustee of Citizens Savings Bank. And I also saw several references to Engelhardt being a very philanthropic person, though I couldn't find specifics about donations made. But this is really important, all of his non-business related activities, although, I mean, being a trustee of a bank and director of a bank is still related to business, just not jewelry. I always think it's very important to mention those details, even though at first blush they can seem rather boring. But it really builds the man, because if you think about someone who was born in Norway, you know, in the middle of the 19th century, lots of brothers and sisters, not particularly wealthy, not poor by any accounts that I read, but not particularly wealthy. And then they are living in the U.S. a few decades later and making this much money, and the trustee of a bank, the director of a bank, that is someone who has achieved status. They are fairly newish money and have achieved status, which in New York City probably wouldn't have been as possible. Somewhere like Providence, probably a little bit more possible in shorter generations and shorter amount of time to gain status in the community. But, you know, lest we not forget why we are here, this is someone that would end up on Titanic in a few years in a first class cabin. He marries Lizzie Macy Webster. There was a Webster who was part of a firm that he worked for previously before he struck out on his own. So I imagine this might have been the daughter of one of those previous employers. She was 22. He was 29 at the time. I'd say fairly respectable for the late 19th century in terms of age gaps. They had four sons and one daughter. Unfortunately, tragedy would strike. Lizzie died in November of 1899 at the young age of 45. Engelhardt then raised his children with the help of his mother, who was, like I mentioned, in the United States and still alive at this point. He often traveled to Europe to survey European markets. Starting around 1906, he began taking his daughter, Helen, on all of his business trips. She would have been 17 years old when she began traveling with him. Now, I find this very interesting, and there's a very, I'll get in trouble for using this word, feminist interpretation of this, and modern interpretation of this. Which is, and when I say I get in trouble, y'all have probably figured this out by now. I love getting in trouble with my trolls. So I almost egg them on sometimes, full disclosure. I think it's so wonderful and modern that it was not his sons who he traveled with to teach the business, but his daughter, Helen. They went often to Paris. Of course they did. They went home to Norway occasionally for Norwegian goat's cheese, which was a family tradition, and they coveted this cheese, which I don't know. I think this is one of my favorite factoids I've ever come across while researching Titanic. So in 1912, they were on one of these vacations. They had gone to Southern Europe. They had gone to Egypt. There are so many Titanic first class passengers who were in Egypt that spring. Think about the Astors, Molly Brown. Helen seems to have very gracefully and with ease sort of incorporated into this transatlantic set, this very wealthy group of Americans that would travel Europe during this time. Talked a lot about those groups of people on the podcast. And they, over the course of their travels that spring, she and her father heard about Titanic. And by her accounts, anecdotal accounts, were very excited to be on the maiden voyage. They boarded in Cherbourg, and they would have been on the tender ship, the Nomadic, which is, of course, thankfully still with us in Belfast, docked in Belfast. And I've been very fortunate to go on it. You can walk right onto it as part of Titanic Belfast's presentations and historical interpretation and tours. And they've restored the floor and the walls, and the interior's not original. I think there's a couple little pieces, but you really can get the best and closest sense of what it was like to walk onto Titanic, because Nomadic was designed to mirror the larger ship. It was designed to be a luxurious entree into your trip. So the moment you stepped onto the tender ship in Cherbourg, you were supposed to feel as though you were already on a luxurious liner, and a seamless aesthetic followed you as you then boarded Titanic out in the middle of the water, because it was too big to come into port at Cherbourg. They boarded in cabins B30 for Engelhardt and B36 for Helen in first class. Engelhardt carried with him his old doctor's bag, where he stored gems and precious stones he found on his travels. And you can see a photo of him online. There is a photograph of Engelhardt, and it suits what he looks like. He looks like a man who, even though he has a ton of money at this point and has created this family dynasty, that he seems like the type of person that would still carry his stuff around in an old leather doctor's bag that maybe belonged to his grandfather or something. He seems like someone who would value that level of tradition and sort of old school ways. If you can tell things about it from a photograph, I don't know. I think sometimes you can. So they met up with friends on board the ship throughout the journey. There's no doubt about that. They would have known quite a few people on board Titanic. Notably, they were friends with Frank and Anna Warren, who are passengers that we know a little bit about, and the Warrens will factor into their story the night of the sinking, which I'll get to in a moment. But this is what happens. I feel like I have done so many episodes where I have the biographical background of someone in their family, and then we also know what happens to them after Titanic, or whether they lived, obviously, or didn't. But in terms of what they did on the ship, not a lot of information. And so sometimes I feel like I'm handing you these episodes where the time on Titanic doesn't exist. There's this empty shell of those days that this glorious ship was out on the ocean. And I think that's because no news is good news. You know, the voyage was smooth and lovely up until the night of April 14th. And so there is sometimes this lack of sources, this lack of information. And all we can imagine is that they dined in first class and they walked the deck, had maybe warm cups of bouillon soup on the deck served by waiters, maybe walked the decks for exercise, perhaps went to the gymnasium for a little bit of physical exertion. They met up with people that they knew. I'm sure Englehart had a brandy or two in the smoking room. But all we can really do is speculate, unfortunately, in terms of that. And when we get to the night of the sinking, one of our largest sources for this family is Helen herself, because, spoiler alert, she does, as a first-class female, survive. That shouldn't be shocking. They have the highest survival rate of a gender and class combo. And so a lot of, a lot of what we have source-wise comes from her. And some of it is from right after the sinking, but a lot of it is from interviews that she gave when she was much older. And so I will give my typical disclaimer that memory is fallible, and sometimes we can learn just as much from how someone recalls something 30 years later, 50 years later, as we can from if we had footage of it. I talk with people all the time. This is like the dinner party question people ask me when they find out that I do this and that this is my job right now. The dinner party question is, what would it have been like if there had been, you know, video cameras on Titanic? If it had been 10, 20 years later and more people had had photos taken, or taken photos, that's a weird way to say it, that there had been more physical illustration of what happened. And it's a curious question. And I do think that if this had happened, not in 1912, but even 1917 or 1920, there would have been so many more people with cameras that, you know, they were getting smaller, they were getting easier to use. There'd have been more people with cameras. I'm shocked that there aren't photos of the night. We obviously have pictures of the lifeboats coming into Carpathia because some people in Carpathia had their cameras out. And we have the photos from Father Brown from on board. And he was, you know, a photographer. He loved photography. That's why he had a camera with him. But I know there were other cameras on board. And I often think it's so strange that there's no first class passenger that thought to bring their camera out and attempt to take photos of what was going on that night. Anyway, that said, yes, if it had happened even a few years later, we would have had more physical documentation of what happened. And I don't know what that would have meant for the historiography. My guess is that there would be a lot less speculation about what happened, that maybe if we had a little bit more physical documentation, people wouldn't feel as liberal as they do with, you know, guessing what happened. I also think that people would feel less sure of the wild speculation. Like it blows my mind that some, I won't name names, but it blows my mind that some established Titanic, you know, researchers and historians just get one narrative in their head that they're sure fill in the blank happened on that night. And they just won't listen to any other option, you know, like, no, so-and-so was in this boat. I just know it. You know, I've done this research and, you know, there's evidence to the contrary. Or perhaps, people that have very hardline beliefs about what Murdoch was doing or what Lowe was up to or what Wilde was up to in terms of the officers. We don't know. I mean, there's 90% of what happened that night we just will never know. It's possible that things happened that would just make our minds bend and that the narrative we have about the sinking is completely wrong. That's one of my favorite things about Titanic. So I've gone on this tangent and I will get off of it. All right. So the night of the sinking, the Ostbys are hanging out with the Warrens. This is the main people that they know and are hanging out with on the ship. And they have their regular clothes on, but they're not bundled. They're cold and they've come up, they've been woken up. They come on deck like many first class passengers. They're just very confused. Some officers are telling them, oh, nothing's wrong. No big deal. You know, but get your life vest on. Some officers are, crew. Some crew are saying that. Some crew are saying, yeah, you know, this is looking a little scary. We need to pay attention to what's going on. So at some point, they are just waiting around the grand staircase. You know, there's a couple of great shots of this in the 1997 movie and some of the other film adaptations as well, where the first class passengers are just kind of mingling. Becomes almost a party-like atmosphere, as passengers like Helen Churchill Candy have told us in their memoirs, because there's a waiting atmosphere. Drinks start to be served. And at some point, Englehart decides that they need warmer clothes. So he leaves Helen near Lifeboat 5, goes back to the stateroom to get clothes. And in the meantime, Helen boards with, I believe, Anna Warren. And she, you know, she's escorted onto a boat. She's a first-class woman that's in a prime location to get on a lifeboat. And so she gets on the lifeboat. And from the accounts that we have, Englehart and Helen sadly never see each other again after that moment. Now, I will tell you more about Helen's thoughts and memories in a moment, but I did want to share that Englehart's body was one of the bodies recovered by the Mackay Bennett, the rescue ship that went out in the days after the sinking. Englehart's body was number 234. And here is what the note card said. Estimated age 52. He was actually 65, so apparently he looked very good for his age. Hair fair, effects, gold-filled teeth, gold watch and chain, knife, glasses, diary, and two pocketbooks and papers. No jewels. No rings, no diamonds. It's interesting that he didn't grab any of those for his pockets. He was first class, so he was embalmed. There was a social hierarchy of how bodies were handled on the Mackay Bennett. I talked about that in my episode on the Mackay Bennett a couple of years ago. Was that a couple of years ago? Wow. It was. This Titanic journey is wild, guys. And so he was embalmed. And he was picked up by his employee, David Sutherland, from Ostby and Barton, who brought him back to Rhode Island. And he was buried in May at the Swan Point Cemetery in Providence. Now, let's roll back to Carpathia, though, because the evening news in Providence reported actually originally erroneously that both Ostbys had survived. And this was probably a mistake made in some sort of process of sending a telegram back and forth. Helen, later on remembering, and this is, again, these are remembrances from the 1950s, 1960s, when she was much older. She remembers that they, when the Carpathia arrived, her brothers were there waiting for her, and they took her to the Belmont Hotel right after. And her brothers at first refused to believe that their father was dead. And you hear this story, the same story with Frank Millett and his sons, as he was erroneously reported to have lived, if I'm remembering correctly. And his sons were there at the dock when the Carpathia arrived, waiting for him. Similar type of situation. So Helen remembers that it was this very chaotic, emotional scene. Her brothers were searching hospitals and charitable groups. They called in more family. They were not ready or willing to given to this idea that Englehart was gone. And we never talk about this, about the mental health aspects of all of this, but I'm sure a lot of families probably did this. I know that in the fan fiction community for Titanic, when fan fiction authors have traditionally written about Jack and Rose, for example, one common trope that is used is, oh, Jack actually survived because, Rose went around to the charitable organizations or the hospitals after the sinking, and he was there. He just had amnesia on Carpathia, or he was knocked unconscious, but he somehow survived. And I, you know, not to be silly by pulling it into fan fiction. I mean, actually, there's some really good fan fictions out there that are written really well, but that's another story for another day. But there are probably a lot of families that did this. And part of it is the mental health aspect of the denial part of grief as one of the early stages. So Helen remembers taking a sleeping pill at the hotel and falling out. And that's probably what I would have done as well. Now, we have some of her accounts from the night. I like to include these after I've finished telling the full story of someone's kind of experiences on the ship, because if they are recollections that were told many years later, I like to kind of note them separately and show that there is a little bit of a separation in how we view the timeline of the night, or at least I believe there should be, because these are from much later. So this would have been when she was an older woman. She remembers, quote, "As the ship began to stand on end, we heard a big grumbling, rattling noise as if everything was being torn from their moorings inside the ship." She also remembers, "I had lost a diamond bar pin, which was given me by my father, which was still pinned to my nightgown aboard ship." So that's what she was thinking about, is this diamond pin on her nightgown as the ship was going down. She remembers seeing Bruce Ismay in his pajamas. So she's one of our sources that puts him in his pajamas, which is, of course, iconic mythology. And she said that Carpathia, that the treatment on the Carpathia was wonderful. She remembers it being great. Lots of hot brandy, fresh food. She was given a room. Of course, she is first class. So that makes sense. We do see reports from second and third class passengers aboard Carpathia that are not quite as glowing. Again, another story for another day. And last but not least, she does claim to have witnessed John Jacob Astor clinging to a lifeboat at the end. Now, that's interesting because Astor, of course, J.J. Astor, is very, very, looms very large in the heroic male mythology of Titanic. And we've talked about it a lot. I won't beat a dead horse here. But I like that. I like the notion that at the end, Astor was maybe clinging on to something to try to live. And I hate this idea that a man could only have been heroic that night if he stood back and just drowned with a cigar, and the cigar would have gone out immediately anyway. But I think it's a much more beautiful and noble story to think that he was wildly and frenetically trying to survive for his wife and his unborn child. Now, on the Astor note, I will go on another tiny little tangent here. There is a new book by Anderson Cooper called Astor. Now, you may remember I talked about his other book, Vanderbilt, a couple of years ago when I was researching for some side projects, just research on the Biltmore. And of course, I live in Asheville now, so the Biltmore looms very large. And I've studied the Vanderbilt and the Astor families very intensely for my work for a couple of years now. But this book is just such a revelation about how we conceptualize the Astors. And Anderson Cooper makes no apologies for his thesis, which is essentially that this great American family that we associate with luxury and the riches and the hotels in New York and in the 20th century, actually with philanthropy, because a lot of the members of the family were big philanthropists in the 20th century. But this dynasty, the Astor dynasty, was born on the backs of really, really bloody interactions on the fur trade and literally blood itself, on some pretty sketchy business practices, and of course, on the backs of thousands and thousands and thousands of immigrants who inhabited tenements and houses on their land in New York, and you know, were living in filth in slums that were lorded over by the Astor family. Now, none of those details are necessarily new, but the way that Anderson Cooper puts the narrative together and peeks in on different generations of the Astor family is, I think, a new thing, and it's really, really exciting to see it done in a mainstream way. Unfortunately, when it comes to J.J. Astor and the Titanic world, for example, he's often written about still in this very heroic, glazy-eyed kind of way. I've read a lot about him. That's not how I think about him anymore. I definitely still think of him as a human being who suffered a horrible fate, and that's very, very tragic, and I would never wish that upon anybody. But I do hear some stories about J.J. Astor that are just not great. So there's our little... got to use the word mythology like 85 times in an episode, or my trolls won't get me anymore. All right. So those are some of her recollections from the night. Helen returned to Providence and, of course, had to physically and mentally recover. She turned back to her responsibilities with Osby Barton. In 1914, she and her brother Harold and one of his daughters, so again, a female being so involved in important business dealings with the company, this is a big deal, became joint owners in Osby and Barton. They also traveled to Germany, and Harold and his daughters, this is in 1914, ding, 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 Harold and his daughter returned, obviously with all of the incoming fears and anxieties about the war, but Helen stayed. She did manage to escape, but barely, and she made it to England and then over to the United States, but another close call. In the 1930s, she was traveling again to Europe. She would go to Paris and Brussels. She actually lived in Brussels for 10 years. So obviously she was not scared of the ocean or getting back on it as some Titanic survivors were. In 1940, she was living in Belgium when bombs started falling from German planes. So she's right there. She's right there with both world wars in the middle of these opening moments. She fled to Lisbon. She remained there for a while and then eventually caught an good old aeroplane back to Providence and made it back by the beginning of 1941. After that, she never did return to Europe. She stayed in Providence for the rest of her life. She volunteered often at the Rhode Island Hospital. She was said to have had many suitors, but she never married. And she died not until 1978 at the age of 88. And she would be buried very close to her father at Swan Point in Providence. So those are the Ostbys that were on Titanic. Now, I do want to talk about their legacy in terms of the jewelry as well. So when I talked to my neighbor about her ring, which is, you know, beautiful, their jewelry is beautiful, I got to thinking about antique jewelry, and I looked online. And actually, you can buy Osby Barton jewelry. It is, I mean, they were the biggest gold ring manufacturer in the world for a while. So this would be, let's put it in modern terms. It's not that weird. It would be like, I don't know, 100 years from now, if you really wanted to buy a special edition vinyl of a Taylor Swift release, like you totally could, because yes, it's coveted and yes, it's a fun, expensive, splurgy thing that someone is paying for now, but it's also a really popular thing, and there's a lot of them. So a lot of them are going to be in basements and attics, and they'll resurface and pop up. I mean, that's a bad example, but I can always get something back to either Titanic, Leo, Taylor, Biltmar. I think I've done it all in this episode. But it's not weird that there are a lot of them available online because they did produce so many rings, but they're very beautiful. So there are some on Etsy. There's some in an auction website, some of the more grandiose ones. And it got me thinking about antique jewelry and how jewelers study the markings on jewelry to validate finds, antique finds. For Ostby Barton, there is this little O and this little B that are stamped inside the rings. There's often a Maltese cross, which I found very interesting. And apparently for a long time in the antique jewelry circle, people believed that if it was an O and a B and a Maltese cross, that meant that Ostby himself, Engelhart, had actually designed that particular ring. That has proven to be false. There are some rings produced in the 1930s and 1940s that have the Maltese cross on it. So obviously that's physically impossible unless he, you know, came back to life and started making rings. Like I said, Providence was a jewelry making capital of the country and the world until well into the 20th century. So a lot of these rings were produced. So if you want one, there's been a great popularity in putting these for sale online because of the Titanic connection. And there's a lot of them available across a wide variety of price points. On the higher end, for example, I found on an estate jewelry website right now, there is an Art Deco diamond antique engagement ring by Ostby and Barton, 18 karat white gold. It's gorgeous, available for $4,000, which I guess, you know, unfortunately, it's crazy to say this, but I guess in terms of an engagement ring and what some people spend on them these days, it's not that wild of a price. Here's the description. Striking Art Deco diamond antique engagement or fashion ring crafted in 18 karat gold by Ostby Barton. The Ostby and Barton jewelry is highly desired by collectors of fine antique jewelry for its beautiful workmanship and historical ties to the Titanic. So see these, an estate jewelry company is being very open about that connection. I appreciate the honesty. This impressive antique ring features a European cut diamond with, oh wow, and these are notes about clarity and color. I don't understand these data points, so I'll let you read into that. But you know, it's a conflict-free stone because it's an antique ring. So I don't know. I mean, maybe a good buy if you're in the market. Edwardian rings, like I mentioned, are very coveted too because of their style. They're very romantic. There's floral motifs. They're very ethereal. Lots of filigree, pearls, very colorful gemstones. So it's an aesthetic that I think really appeals to, to me. My wedding ring, which is pretty simple gold band, but it has sort of a floral filigree design instead of a stone. Just wanted to keep it really simple. That was my choice. Sort of almost looks like the Ostby Barton designs, I realized as I was researching these. And so, I don't know, now I'm in the market for an Ostby Barton just like fashion ring, maybe one of the gemstone ones. I might splurge at some point or ask my husband to splurge for a birthday or Christmas at some point because they really, really are beautiful. So there's just a little slice of Titanica that I never expected to run across. I always love a research cross train. I love being able to explore topics I didn't think I would when I committed to studying Titanic jewelry, not necessarily something I would have thought of if you told me what I would be researching 3 years ago. So always fun to just be all over the place. And as always, I thank you for listening. I am getting back into my groove on reporting. Not a journalist. On recording for this episode. So my voice not 100%. My brain, maybe not 100%, coming off of the holidays, have not gotten my groove back. But there are some exciting things coming down the pipeline. One of them, very, very exciting, that I can't quite share yet, but as soon as I can, I will. There's a lot of Titanic in the air. And I just want to thank you, as always, for being here, for listening, for supporting the podcast. I really have reached a very pivotal point now in my journey, in my life with Titanic, which is that I am sitting down to write a book about my experiences. And if you have ever written a book or edited one, or, you know, been a friend or a partner of someone that's written a book, it's a very long and arduous and challenging process. And it's going to be a journey this year, but I am working on that. And so I really appreciate your support for sticking by the podcast. For my Patreon members, you are, again, quite literally helping to fuel this project. Because of Patreon, I am able to devote as much time as I am to working on the podcast and working on the book. So thank you. And if you are someone who has enjoyed the pod and thought about Patreon, you know, it really is a key thing in my life right now to see this whole project and this whole Titanic journey through to the end. So it's very much appreciated. I do also have an account on Buy Me a Coffee that I can link on Instagram and in the show notes as well, if you would rather do just a one-time donation towards the writing process. That would be so appreciated as well. As always, if you have a moment to rate and review, it goes a long way, helps visibility in the podcatcher players. I did want to do something I've meant to do for a long time, and I just have never remembered, which is, you know, I try not to read reviews of the podcast too much because, like I've mentioned before, there's a lot of troll activity going on. As with anything on the internet can be a really gross place, also a really beautiful place, obviously. But once in a while, I'll check the reviews of the pod, and I'm amazed, you know, some people really take the time to write something thoughtful and wonderful. And so I wanted to start featuring the occasional review because I really am grateful for them. So I will feature this one today that I noticed. It came from November of this year on Apple Podcast. And this is from Alyssa Marie 15. And she says, "There is nothing more satisfying than discovering a new podcast that has tons of episodes at the ready for your binging pleasure and then looking forward to and thoroughly enjoying each and every one. This is my current favorite and I love it so, so much. I love LA. I love all of the guests she has on the show. I love her dedication to the subject. I love all things Titanic, and this here is where it's at." And I started to cry when I read that because it's, you know, if you're a creator, an artist, or a writer, or media person, or just anything in this realm at all, you know, there are so many negatives that can pull you in every day. There's so many trolls, especially on the internet, that can pull you in on any given day. And for someone to take their time and to offer that kind of thoughtfulness and positivity, and the idea that I am bringing that kind of joy to someone, it just makes it all worth it. It makes me feel so happy. So thank you, Alyssa Marie 15, for taking the time to leave that review. If you have time to leave a rating or review, please do. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your week. Thank you for being a Titaniac with me, and I will see you back fairly soon. Probably within the next week and a half, finally, with Titanic on film, Titanic Blood and Steel. I have been talking about that one for ages, and I've finally had the time to craft the episode. So we'll be watching that. Oh, and also over on Patreon, I did do a bonus episode a few days ago about the 4K transfer, the new DVD release of 97's Titanic, James Cameron's Titanic. So if you want to hear my thoughts about that, that is up on Patreon. All right, bye, you guys. Talk soon. Unsinkable, the Titanic podcast, is written, hosted, and produced by me, LA Beatles, and the theme song was composed by my husband, John Beatles.